Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the October 8, 2017 session, focusing on Matthew 21, verses 33 through 46, Caretaker Failure. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm David Adams.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
Well, Daniel is away still for this week's episode, but we look forward to having him back with us next week. But we do have David Adams with us again. David, welcome back. David is the editor for the Faith Element Resources, and he teaches as an adjunct at the Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. And David, we're so glad you were able to join us again.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, we have just wrapped up a series in Exodus, and we have a passage from Matthew tonight. Bert, would you be able to get us started with this one?
Sure. And before we pick up with this text, we need to understand some of the context of the things that's been happening before, because as you said, we've been in Exodus. So as we read today's text, here's where Matthew structures his gospel story. Jesus has just entered Jerusalem, you know, the triumphal entry, Palm Sunday, all that. And Jesus is walking right into the very center of a hornet's nest. The hornet's nest being the religious leaders and their doctrinal certainty and their self-righteousness. And then, as Matthew tells it, Jesus starts poking at that nest and jabbing at it and provoking all the hornets. He's swinging a whip and turning over tables and disrupting the activities in the temple. He's accusing those in charge of turning God's house into a den of thieves. He curses the fig tree and explains what's going on with that. Then he comes right out and tells the religious leaders, the officials of the temple faith, God's self-appointed defenders, that their most despised people, the tax collectors and prostitutes, are way ahead of them when it comes into getting into God's kingdom. So the hornet's nest is swarming all around Jesus when we start reading with this parable in verse 33. It's a story that could be about labor. It could be about social revolution. It could be about justice, power to the people kind of a thing. It is a story in which we'd expect the absent owner to be the bad guy and the laborers of the field to be the good guys. But instead, it's the laborers, the tenants, who are filled with greed, who are dishonest, and who have no integrity. They willfully break their agreement with the owner. They attempt to seize control of the vineyard as their own, and they try to send messages back to the landowner. And like in all the good mobster movies, when they send messages back, it's always sent with violence and bloodshed. They beat and stone and kill the owner's representatives. The owner even sends his own son to talk with the tenants. And they see this as their chance to get everything they want once and for all. So they grab the son, they drag him away, they kill him. And their message to the owner echoes throughout the land. Your son sleeps with the fishes. Okay, that's a Godfather reference, not biblical Greek, but you get the idea. And Jesus doesn't finish the story. He invites his listeners to finish the story. The ones in charge, the temple keepers, the scholars of the scriptures, the other religious leaders, and he simply asks, now when the owner himself comes, what do you think will happen? And they answer with the obvious. They answer with what makes perfect sense. They answer with what is the right and just thing to do. They answer with how they would react if they were the owners. Well, he'll kill them all. Rightfully so, that wretched bunch. He'll hire some honest and decent, hardworking folks to tend the vineyard who will be all on the up and up when it comes to pay up. And Jesus agrees with them. And then he quotes scriptures to them, a scripture about the stone that the builders rejected, and that stone becomes the cornerstone. And then Jesus says that's what they've been doing to God's kingdom. So God's going to take the kingdom away from them and give it to people who will live out a kingdom kind of life. So you can imagine how the leaders reacted to this. They knew exactly that he was saying they messed it up. They'd gotten it all wrong. They are not God's chosen ones any longer. God's going to give it to someone else. Of course, we understand what happens next with Jesus. He gets crucified. The nature of the Christian faith in America has been undergoing a seismic shift for some time now. And I think this parable gets right to the heart of it, right to the heart of why. Those of us who have grown up with white Protestant American Christianity have mistakenly assumed that we have been the owners of the vineyard rather than merely the tenants. I'm indebted to our pastor and professor friend, Dr. Brett Younger here, who points out in talking about this text, you know, we think our life is ours. We think our church is ours. We think our faith is ours. We think God is ours. It's our building. It's our budget. It's our doctrine. It is our sincerely held religious belief. We want to be Christians, Brett Younger points out, but we want to still be in charge. So we keep our distance from Christ and what Jesus teaches. And instead we focus on rules and flat literal interpretations that have no context or no history or no grace. And we learn how to explain to ourselves and explain to others how Jesus really didn't mean everything that he so clearly said he meant. Those of us who have grown up in the dominant white Protestant American Christian denominations are discovering that God expected us to tend to the vineyards, not control it as our own. God's still the owner, and God will pass the kingdom into hands that will care for it and nurture it and follow in the way of Jesus. Why? Because we have made Christianity about power and control and certainty and exclusion. When, as Jesus's very life reminds us, as all of his teachings tell us, as do so much of our Bible from the Old Testament through Paul's letters, that without love, it's all for naught. Again, as Brett Younger says, God's love is the cornerstone that the builders rejected. If the people fall, the stone that kills them is their misunderstanding of the love of God. As Christianity in the U.S. is being turned upside down, I can't help but wonder if Matthew's gospel is helping us understand why.
I still get caught up in thoughts about the fact that they didn't just want the fruits of the vineyard, and they didn't want to say their own. They wanted control of it. They wanted to make it their vineyard and really totally usurp the owner as if something belonged to them, something was owed them, and just to totally displace the vineyard in that particular story. And I kind of wonder sometimes if we haven't gotten off on that particular foot, where we feel like, well, God's told us these things, and we've done what God's requested by the books that we've written, so now we're owed something. You know, and if God doesn't give us what we're owed, we'll just have to go take it. Make God pay up, because after all, that was part of the deal. And if I didn't like the deal I got, well, maybe I'll try to get myself a better deal. This whole idea of transactionalizing faith, you know, to make it one of those things where it goes beyond caring about people anymore. It goes just beyond what you can get, you know, and how you can control and how you can be the person who decides how the narrative is going to go. It just seems so false to what God wanted us to do. You know, but that seems to be where we've gone. And if you say things about that that make you sound less than comfortable, you can be quickly marginalized because people don't want to hear that message being told. I know you talked about this before we came on and started this particular conversation, but there was that great quote that everyone attributed to Stephen Colbert when he talks about how if we're going to be, you know, if we really believe in Jesus Christ, if we believe that he said that we're supposed to help the poor, then we either have to admit we don't believe in him, or we're going to believe we do believe in him, but we just don't want to do it, what he wants us to do. And aside from that statement, what was shocking about it was not the statement itself. It's people were so upset that he said it. Mm-hmm. Like, how dare you say that to us? How dare you point this out to us?
Right.
Like, you know, you can't question us. And more upset about the fact that he made the point than what the point itself actually was, because we can't talk about the fact that these people are in the vineyard making these kinds of plans. There's another piece of that too, is God owns the vineyard and not us. And it's real hard for certain people you can't name names because it's probably all of us. It's real hard for people to not think of it as our vineyard because we've labored there so long. We've been there. We're kind of used to it. It's a comfortable vineyard. But it's not ours, and it never was ours.
I think that's a fascinating point. And I wonder if at least the tradition of the church that I have grown up in, you know, we sometimes talk about the Spirit, but we become uncomfortable pretty quickly with the idea of the Spirit because, you know, the Spirit's kind of the opposite of what we really like. We like defined, you know, that's why we like rules and laws and very clear things about who's in and who's out and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But the Spirit is this wispy, moves where it will, does creative things, goes new places. That's scary. That's unsettling. And I wonder if there's a relationship between our wanting to keep the vineyard for ourselves. We know what the vineyard is. We know what it should be. Opening ourselves up to the Spirit means it's not ours, and it might need to grow in ways that we can't see or predict.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, years ago, there was this theology that was developed, or this philosophy that was developed, very Augustinian, the idea that chaos is evil, and it's a threat to things. The natural ordered life, the ordered universe, is what's good, and chaos is bad. And so you can't trust things that aren't able to be controlled. You know, and we've spent over 1,000 years or so now expecting God to be something that's controllable. And if we get in a situation that we can't control faith, and we can't control where it goes, that's just not something we trust. We've got to get control of that thing. We can't let it run loose. Long story. We had a children's service at a church once, and we thought we'd really do a children's worship service where the children got to speak, and it was all them. And at one time during the course of the service, we had an adult sermon. And I let some adults come forward, and they sat at the steps, and I gave them their adult sermon. I got an atomic fireball and put it in my mouth and was sucking out for a few minutes. I said, this is like the Spirit. It's really spicy and hot, and it's kind of daring and risky and stuff. And you don't know where it's going to take you, and it's not for everybody, but it can really enhance your day and offer you a unique experience. And they were into that until I pulled it out of my mouth and offered it for somebody else. Here, why don't you all try it? And no one wanted it.
Nobody wanted it.
But that was the point I was making about the Spirit is, we're all excited when we see the Spirit going on and doing these great things, but it's not for us. It's kind of icky. It's kind of dangerous. We don't want to be involved with that. It can't be controlled.
Yes.
I know I've mentioned this on podcasts before, but our United Church of Christ family has a slogan, a phrase, a motto.
God is still speaking.
God is still speaking. Mm. And I love that because for some of us, our tradition has been, no, it's all been settled 2,000 years ago, or when, maybe not 2,000, but when we got our canon, and we got our canon, you know, canonized. I don't know how else you would say that, right? When we canonized our scriptures.
That's cleaner.
That's it. It's closed. The book is closed.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about adding new scriptures or new things, but that's how we look at it, that we've got this text, and it is completely settled, and nothing new can happen. And now from then on, we have to live our lives according to this sealed text. And I love the idea of the Holy Spirit. God is still speaking. When the Spirit moves, you feel alive. And the stories of this text hold become our stories. And we've talked about that a lot on the podcast of, you know, especially with the Exodus, how these are our stories today. That's alive. And that's movement. And that's taking us places that make us uncomfortable. That's the Spirit. It's living. And I think what Jesus is saying in this text to the religious leaders is, you know, what's happening in our time has always happened before. These religious leaders had settled on their text and sealed it up, and this is it. And we will stay in this moment of understanding in whatever, and never shall our understanding change. And Jesus was moving, and Jesus was speaking. And Jesus was going in all kinds of places that their text couldn't hold.
You know, our missiologists are reminding us that the Christian faith is growing. It is a growing faith, but it is not growing in the places where it used to grow.
Right.
It's mostly a Southern Hemisphere religion now. I mean, that's where the real energy and growth is. And in fact, there are some groups in the Southern Hemisphere sending missionaries to the USA because we are, you know, we are now a field, a mission field for them. And it's interesting that, you know, we're having this conversation about this text and its relationship with the movement of the Spirit. And yet that is exactly what defines the Southern Hemisphere experience of Christianity, is it a very, very much is a Spirit-driven approach to Christianity. And I'm just sharing that. I'm not sure where to go with it, but it just came to mind.
For some of us, you know, some folks have told their stories, their testimony of how they've changed positions or become more open to LGBT persons in their churches. And I remember hearing one person talk about she had a brother who was gay, and he refused to let go of his Christian faith, despite the fact that the church he grew up in said, you cannot be a Christian and be gay, and would not let him in. He refused to let go of his faith. He loved Jesus, and he knew Jesus loved him. And he moved off to a large city up north, a major metropolitan area, and he became involved in leadership with a gay church, because 10, 15 years ago, there was the church, and then there were these, you know, the gay community that wanted to have church that couldn't be church, so they started their own. And so there was the gay church in this big city, and she said that my friend said she went to visit him. And when she went to visit him at his church, their worship service was alive in ways she has not even experienced, not even at tent revivals. She said there was tears and laughter and cheering and silence and awe. She said they were alive in the Spirit, and the Spirit was moving, and they were supporting each other and hugging each other. And then they talked about what they were going to do during the week. And that church during the week, that little church during the week, were feeding the homeless, and they were dealing with drug addicts, and they were dealing with everyone on the street that all these big, huge, steepled churches had closed their doors to. And they were doing the work of the church. And she said, I knew then that God is here, and that the Spirit is alive here. And she went back to her church where she remained, but she had changed her position because of visiting this, that God's vineyard was growing in all kinds of weird and wonderful ways, you see, that not in the controlled vineyard. And I think this LGBT thing is one of those ways that we issue statements and we come out because we're not going to grow that in our vineyard, and we're not going to allow that in our vineyard. Well, God's planted that vineyard, and it's growing in many different places.
You know, if you study church history, you know that the church moves through different phases, just like we do in our lives. And I can't remember the historian, but who phrased it as this movement between chaos and order, much like David Adams was talking about earlier, that we can even look at the movement of the church as periods where it seemed chaotic, but it was the church reimagining itself, following the Spirit, moving into new ways of being church, and then into periods of order. And both can be good. Sometimes we need the order. Sometimes we need the chaos. And it feels like maybe in our conversation, we might be wondering if it is time for a little bit more chaos in our faith and in our churches, where we are more open to the work of the Spirit, more open to those places where we think we can't go, but we ought to go. More open to those words of Jesus that are hard to hear, but we need to hear. May we remember that this is not our vineyard, and that God's plan for it is so much more than anything we might imagine or build. Give us the courage and the wisdom to let go and to let God truly lead us into a future, which is certainly a good one. Thank you all for this good word tonight.
Thank you.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.